This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
We open this evening's The Space Show as we did last week with Speedy West's 1961 tune, Reflections from the Moon. We wonder if you can figure out why it is relevant. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, Odysseus, now dormant on the moon. What did it achieve during its truncated life? Well, let's hear a little bit more of this opening music and see if you can figure out why. After Intuitive Machines Odysseus lunar landing made a semi-successful landing on the moon, the private company commanded the crippled craft to transmit images back to Earth. However, these attempts returned unusable imagery. Then, on February the 27th, a new attempt was made and several images were successfully transmitted. They confirmed that one of the six landing legs had broken and that the craft was tilted over on its side. However, Odysseus is not fully horizontal as initially reported. Another image showed the capsized craft was near a large crater. Late last week, as Odysseus was losing powering sunlight on its solar panels, a press briefing was held at the Johnson Space Center. New details about what happened to the landing craft during and after touchdown were revealed. We also heard of how the radio telescope in Parkes played a crucial role in the mission.
Good afternoon, and welcome to NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. I'm Nilufer Ramji with NASA Communications. Thanks for joining us. Intuitive Machines' lander, named Odysseus, carried six NASA science instruments to the South Pole region of the Moon as part of the agency's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, or CLPS, initiative and Artemis campaign. The IM-1 mission is the first U.S. soft landing on the moon in more than 50 years, successfully landing on February 22nd. Joining us to provide insight on this notable mission and to answer questions, we have Steve Altemus, Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Intuitive Machines, Dr. Tim Crane, the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Intuitive Machines, and finally, Dr. Sue Lederer, Project Scientist for CLPS at NASA Johnson. First, we'll start with some initial remarks from each of our briefers. We'll now begin with opening remarks from Steve Altemus. Steve, take it away.
Thank you, Nilufer. It's such an exciting day to be here at this time in the mission. Last time we talked, we were getting very sporadic data back and trying to understand the situation of the mission, but we've conducted a very successful mission to this point, and we expect to go to the completion of the mission as planned. With a little treat in store for us as we go forward beyond that over the next 2 and 3 weeks. Currently, in the mission control room, Odysseus continues to generate solar power. We are projecting a time where the solar power generation will not allow OD to continue sending down telemetry, but we will put OD to sleep and expect to wake him up here in the next 2 or 3 weeks for a development test objective, which is actually to see if we can, when the sun illuminates the solar panel again, we get a signal back from this lander. And so we're excited about that point. Flight controllers are analyzing all the data that's coming down. We've gotten data from all of the payloads, commercial and NASA payloads to date, and NASA will talk about those. Dr. Su will give you a rundown on what we've recovered. What we've gotten in terms of data on the vehicle is a tremendous amount of the guidance navigation control data, all the propulsion data, all the performance data for the vehicle that will allow us to completely reconstruct the mission and tell you all of the idiosyncrasies that went on throughout the mission, and we'll do a mission reconstruction and then evaluation on how the performance of this mission will play itself forward to missions 2 and 3 and subsequent missions. We expect that the planned mission was going to extend on the surface for 144 hours. We expect that Odie will sleep after that. We left every bit nothing left on the table. Every commodity, everything was used. All the helium was used. All the methane was used. All the power was used. And so we used up every bit of every ounce of consumables we took with us and generated on the way to complete this mission. We returned to the moon as a commercial company, but we had multiple government agencies that we worked with. We then had a whole series of international partners that we used as not only our lunar data network antenna dishes on the ground, but also in the supply chain. We had Australia, the United Kingdom, Japan, South Africa, the United States dishes, and KSAT dishes, KSAT based out of Norway, in India, Singapore, Dubai, French Guiana, and Mauritius in India. It's been a daunting journey. We were met with over 11 critical mission challenges.
An image taken during the landing showed one of the struts to one of the 6 landing legs had broken.
This is a picture of Odie on the surface of the moon, touching down with its engine firing. You see here the landing gear pieces broken off there on the left of the image. The landing gear did what it was supposed to do and protect the lander as it landed on the surface. The engine plume interaction with the surface gives us this excellent view of how the ejecta, the regolith, moves away from the plume interaction. There's scientific information in that data right there. What you don't see in this picture is that our navigation system landed us with precision and landed us softly on the moon. The shock absorbers took the load, and the lander now tilted over gently, and we think it's about 30 degrees, and communicating all the way down to Earth. And I think Tim is going to give you an estimate of how much data we've actually brought down. There's a little image in the center of the white patch on this that's an American flag. I want to highlight that American flag was a donation by NASA and is from 1970 in the Apollo program, and it was a certified piece of flight hardware. And we took that American flag and we proudly put it on Odysseus and carried it to the moon like it should have been done 52 years ago. The landing gear was subject to an environment that it was not designed for, a harsher landing that was outside its design limits.
The images released clearly showed that Odysseus was tilted over, but not completely laying on its side, as had been suspected.
You see that we're tilted over slightly, still more upright than we initially thought. We did land upright, we captured data, and then we tilted over slowly in about 2 seconds and came to rest either on the opposite helium tank or a computer shelf, and were able to communicate, get all 6 payloads data back, plus all the commercial payloads, and continue to transmit.
With more data now on hand than had been available last week, a better description of how the landing occurred can now be made.
Hi, Eric Berger with Ars Technica. First question is for Steve or Tim. Can you describe how the lander came to be gently landing on the moon? I guess it's only about 30% tipped over. Do you think it's leaning against a rock? Or something's holding it up?
So with respect to piecing together what happened at landing, we received telemetry. If you remember, on the evening of landing, we had no communication signal, and then a weak signal. And in our consoles, the data was up to a point and then frozen until that communication was restored. So we had an indication that we had landed and we were upright with that stale data. And when we came back and looked at it, when we restored the communications, we noticed that we were getting the IMU telling us we have see gravity more in the Z direction than in the X direction. Well, then we did a reconstruction where we actually calculated based the trajectory and the flight dynamics guys calculated that we actually came down just short of our landing site at a higher elevation than where our landing site was going to be. About a 1.5 kilometer difference between the ellipse of uncertainty for our landing and where we touched down. That elevation was higher. So we came in with more downward velocity and we came more with more horizontal velocity. And so we hit harder and sort of skidded along the way. And we see that disruption in the regolith from the LRO data that we've been able to get from LRO and ASU. And that discoloration says that we came down with the engine firing because the automated flight manager had not moded to where it was trying to sense and shut down the engine. We saw a spike when we touched down in the engine combustion chamber that was like if you shut off the full thrust with by landing on the surface. So we know the engine belt contacted the surface. The landing gear took the bulk of the load and we broke one or two possibly landing gear. And so we sat there upright with the engine firing for a period of time. And then as it wound down, the vehicle just gently tipped over. And in our simulation with 1/6 gravity, we showed that it took about 2 seconds. And we landed on a 12-degree slope. And then that 12-degree slope compounded with the helium tank underneath or a radio shelf would put us at an angle that's approximately 30 degrees off the surface. And we have that photo now to confirm that's the orientation. We also know the roll orientation when we were going to set the high gain antenna towards Earth and the solar arrays for the sun. We know that roll worked, but we know when we landed, the top deck solar array was shadowed and we weren't generating power with the top deck solar array. So we got that orientation right. So those were all the parameters that had to unfold over time to get us a good understanding of where we came. And then just today we have this picture of us leaning gently.
If you heard our space show program last week, you will remember that an urgent change had to be made to the computer software controlling the descent to the moon.
You know, the idea to pull the range telemetry from the NASA Doppler LiDAR was interesting and change out the laser range finder callouts in the navigation application. All that was very straightforward to go calculate. Part of that was put in a table, but part of that had to mean that we had to rewrite the navigation application software. And when you do that, to upload it to the vehicle, you actually have to stop guidance, navigation, and control. And when we ran that in the simulation and we ran that on the flat sat, it did not like being rebooted like that software. And we saw the guidance drift way off. We saw a lot of helium usage, and that was very sporty. So I think in a very time-crunched time, getting ready for power descent, we had to work feverishly to get that sequence of events, almost like Fred Hayes in Apollo 13, where we're trying to figure out the sequence of events to reinitialize the software, in particular, reinitialize navigation.
NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter successfully photographed Odysseus on the moon, allowing an accurate identification of the landing site. This, as you've heard, was not the intended place. The question was, why did Odysseus touch down off target, and how did that offset cause the bad landing?
Good afternoon. A question for Tim or Steve. If you had a working laser range finder, how would the final phases of landing potentially played out differently? Would you have been able to recognize you were approaching an area of a higher elevation and adjusted the landing appropriately so that you would touch down more softly, or would the slope of the landing area have made it difficult to land anyway? And then also, you know, we heard on Friday about the Herculean efforts you made to incorporate the NDL data into your software. Did that not help on the final phases of the landing? How did that play out? Thanks.
If we would have had the laser rangefinders, we would have nailed the landing. We actually have a terrain map built in to the system that anticipates the terrain we're going to fly over. It is robust to variations in that terrain. We've tested it for robustness to make sure that if we're off a little bit, it doesn't throw us off, and then it converges at the landing site. I'm confident if our laser rangefinders had been integrated in the system, we would have absolutely hit the bullseye. With respect to the NDL, what we had done, we absolutely succeeded in wiring the measurements in to the laser rangefinder registers. We absolutely succeeded in remapping the geometry of the laser rangefinder laser beams to what the NDL laser beams were. And we did all of that in the navigation algorithm. The part we missed was there is a data valid flag that's set all the way back in the laser rangefinder itself. And we needed to populate that in the navigation software that we patched to basically hard code it to one. And because we missed that, the navigation algorithm said, you've got measurements, but I don't see my data valid flag that I'm expecting from the original laser rangefinder. So those did not process after all. So basically we landed with our IMU and our optical navigation data flow algorithms, which were unique. It's the first time anybody's flown this algorithm, and it exceeded expectations because we lived to tell about it.
In a few moments, we're going to hear how Australia had a crucial role in the Odysseus landing and mission on the moon.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the Space Show. Although Odysseus carried NASA experiments, the mission was a private one by the Houston-based company Intuitive Machines. As such, it did not have full use of NASA's deep space tracking network. The company had to cobble together a network that included Goonhilly Limited in Cornwall and CSIRO's Parkes Radio Telescope.
And I am here now with Trent Martin, the Intuitive Machines Senior Vice President of Space Systems. Thanks for joining us, Trent.
Thanks.
We're here to talk a little bit about the Lunar Data Network. This is a private deep space network, belongs to Intuitive Machines. How does it differ to have this commercially available space network? And how is that different from NASA's deep space network?
So when we first got onto the Commercial Lunar Payload Services contract, we were trying to find a way that we could get our data from our landers back to the Earth. We were worried that the Deep Space Network, which is often oversubscribed, particularly with James Webb Space Telescope now, that we would have limited time. So what we did was we created a network of large dishes across the planet that allow us to take our data from the moon and deliver it down to the Earth.
And we initially tested this out during the Artemis 1 mission. So how did Intuitive Machines work that out?
Yes, we worked a reimbursable Space Act agreement with NASA to allow us to test our network not only with Artemis at 430,000 kilometers, but also with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, as well as the GOES satellite.
Okay, thanks so much. It's really exciting to see this in action.
Because of the botched landing, Parkes had a greater than planned role in downlinking the data from Odysseus.
Also, can you explain a little more why you could pull more data when over Australia and not at other times?
Yeah, with respect to why over Australia, we do have our network of dishes that range anywhere from 18 meters to 32 meters, except for the dish in Parkes, Australia, which is part of CSIRO, and that's the dish. They made a movie about it called The Dish. It's a 64-meter dish. Now, it can only receive, but it has a very sensitive ability to detect radio signals. And we were transmitting not through our high-gain antenna, we were transmitting through a Omni antenna about the size of this water bottle. And that's what we had to transmit. And oh, by the way, it's not pointing at Earth. And so the way our engineers were able to work with the engineers at Parkes to pull that data down was fantastic, but we could only do it when we were within the physical limitations of the Parkes dish to go horizon to horizon. Oh, by the way, when you move a 64-meter dish, if the wind kicks up above a certain level, it stops. And so we all of a sudden became hedge meteorologists trying to predict what the winds would be like during our data passes. But I really have to give it to the team in Australia. They did a fantastic job allowing us to get this critical data down.
Last week, and again this week, we began the program with the tune Reflections from the Moon. And we ask you to figure out why. Remember how a LIDAR works? LIDAR means light detection and ranging. A laser sends out a pulse of light, either visible or infrared, which reflects off the lunar surface and is received back at the satellite. By timing the transit time to and return, the distance to the surface can be calculated. Essential information for a safe landing. During the Apollo and Surveyor landings in the 1960s and 70s, the Earth was high in the sky. Reflected signals off the Moon were not a problem. However, Odysseus is near the lunar south pole, and the Earth is near the horizon. Radio signals from the lander to the Earth both travel directly to Earth and reflect at a glancing angle off the lunar surface. This reflection causes problems.
And so our antennas are in an off-nominal configuration. The reason some of this data took a while for us to get to is we had to really work with our in-network lunar telemetry partners, and then also with DSN to figure out what this strange environment was. Absolutely, our signals were bouncing off the Moon. So we were receiving both the direct path signals from our radio and the opposite polarization as well. And so we had to sort through exactly how to do that. But once we got it down, we got into a rhythm where we could monitor health and send some basic commands for about 16 hours a day. And then we'd come over Australia and we were able to really pull down data for about 8 hours at a time. And that was intense. That's where we had everybody in there. We had no dead air, just like in the radio business. There was no dead air, right? We wanted data coming down all the time. Well, I want to fix this payload. I want to work with scouts. Great. Be downloading data while you're working with scouts. And so that was kind of the operation we had.
Hence our choice of music. Reflections off the Moon. Before Odysseus was launched, NASA's program scientist Deborah Needham described the Malapert landing site and the six NASA payloads.
The six NASA instruments on this delivery are conducting investigations ranging from demonstrating techniques to promote safe and precise landings to how engine plumes and celestial radiation modify the lunar surface. Before I give you an overview of the science payloads, I'd like to tell you about the landing site. The landing site for this mission is Malapert A, an impact crater within 10 degrees latitude of the Moon's south pole. Looking towards the south pole from Malapert A lies the tallest peak on the Moon, Malapert Mountain, some of the coldest regions of the Moon in the permanent shade of Cabeus Crater, previously investigated by NASA's LCROSS mission, and the destination of NASA's upcoming Viper mission, Mons Mouton. The south polar region is important for NASA as it's where the agency plans to send future Artemis crewed missions. The instruments aboard IM-1's mission will help NASA better understand the environment in which Artemis astronauts will live and work. Now let me tell you about the six NASA payloads onboard IM-1. The Navigation Doppler LIDAR, or NDL, is a laser-based sensor that will help the spacecraft determine how far above the surface it is and how fast it's moving. After arriving at the Moon and heading towards the landing site, NDL will provide real-time navigation to help guide the spacecraft precisely to the intended landing location, leading to a gentle touchdown. Next, the radio frequency mass gauge, or RFMG, is a space-age fuel gauge to measure the amount of cryogenic propellant in spacecraft fuel tanks like those in IM-1's Nova Sea Lander. If you think about your car's fuel gauge, it's very useful for knowing when to refuel. But that technology won't work in the zero gravity of space, where fluid does not settle to the bottom of the tank. Future spaceflight missions using cryogenic propellants can potentially take the guesswork out of monitoring propellant reserves and save fuel by using this technology. Next, the Lunar Retroreflector Array, or LRA, is an array of 8 retroreflectors that will enable precision laser ranging to determine the distance from an orbiting or landing spacecraft to the LRA on the lander. LRA is a passive optical instrument and will function as a permanent location marker on the moon for decades to come. Next, the stereo cameras for lunar plume surface studies will record effects of engine plume interactions with the lunar surface and investigate how dust kicked up by the plume affects the landing vehicle and lunar surface. The goal is to understand how the landing event changes the lunar surface topography to help future landers safely land on the lunar surface. Next, Lunar Node 1, or LN1, will transmit navigation and communication radio signals to guide incoming and outgoing vehicles with precision in an overall effort to reduce the amount of fuel required for future safe landings. And finally, radio wave observations at the lunar surface photoelectron sheath, or ROLSes, has 4 antennas that will measure the density of the electrons ejected from lunar dust by photons of sunlight, as well as detect radio emissions from the sun, Jupiter, and Earth's aurora, and dust impacts that can all influence the environment that future science instruments and Artemis astronauts may experience while working at the lunar surface.
At last week's press briefing, she was pleased to report on how these payloads had worked.
So the data that we've collected has come in a number of phases. During transit, we were able to operate all of our powered payloads on transit. On descent and landing, our navigation Doppler LiDAR NDL was able to collect data that will help us to land safely in the future. And on the surface, the 3 payloads that were planned to operate on the surface have all been able to collect data. So I just want to take a little bit of time to go through each of the payloads to try to really help you to understand what we've been working on. LN1 is a navigation and communication beacon that transmits radio signals back down to the Earth. They were able to complete 4 passes with Goldstone and Madrid, and 2 more passes to the Madrid ground station on the surface. So we mentioned earlier that LN1 has really stepped up to the task when IM came to us and said, hey, we really could use some help with navigation information. So I was in the car on the way home after pulling a triple shift. Sorry, Joel. and calling the LN1 PI, and I said, hey, Evan, is there a way that we can get your help with the navigation and working with the DSN? And he so calmly and coolly said, we're a navigation beacon. We're here to help you navigate. And that's what they did. So very proud of that team. ROLSes is the next one, and this is the radio wave observations at the lunar surface of the photoelectron density sheath. They have 4 antennas that were planned to be deployed on the surface. And Odie had a little surprise for us on the way with a little bit of help from the sun, creating a little bit more heat than we expected for the frangible. We did pop one of the antennas as we were in transit. And we took that as a sign that we were ready to start collecting science data. And why not take that opportunity? So while we had not planned to operate ROLSes at all in transit, we were able to get not only checkout data, but a fair bit of science data with that antenna that we hadn't planned. So a little bit of bonus science. Thank you for that. So we're very happy about that. The remaining antennas were deployed on the surface, and we were also able to collect science data with those antennas deployed as was expected for that payload. Just a couple of notes from the ROLSes team that they have just started downloading this data in the last few days, and already they can tell us that they have detected frequencies of radio noise from the Earth But the indication is that the lower frequency data, Earth is a lot more quiet than they expected, below 15 megahertz. But at the higher frequency, the Earth is definitely shouting out a bit. So, and their observations are also consistent with a radio quiet sun. So they're already collecting and really analyzing this data, and we have now downloaded additional data that we've collected just as we were getting ready for this brief. So we have all the ROLS's data down. SCALPS is the stereo cameras for lunar plume surface studies, and their goal was to detect the plumes being ejected and creating surface plumes or surface interaction plumes with the engine on the way down. We unfortunately had some hardware problems that did not allow the SCALPS instrument to operate during descent. However, one of the SCALPS team members, shout out to them, came up with an idea to potentially do some troubleshooting. And just 2 days ago, with very little sleep for all of us, the IM team was able to work with us very collaboratively in figuring out how to change how we were collecting data with the SCALPS instrument so that we were able to operate SCALPS from the surface of the moon just this morning. So a lot of people working a lot of hours, and a shout out to the SCALPS team for all their dedication in helping us and helping IM to figure out a way to get SCALPS to work. NDL is the Navigation Doppler LiDAR. It's for precise velocity and range sensing. We've talked about NDL and what they've been able to do. They are designed to help safely navigate a vehicle to the surface. All of the NDL data has now been received, and NDL reports that their instrument has worked far better than they expected, so we're very excited to see the final data outcomes from NDL. RFMG is a radio frequency mass gauge. They were able to collect data while we were tanking on the surface here on the Earth before we launched. As well as so loading those propellants on the launch pad, also during coast in the zero gravity of environment of space that this allows us to do. It's very hard to do that if you don't have gravity pulling down your propellant, as well as during descent to the surface of the moon, as well as in lunar orbit. So we collected a lot of data with RFMG, and this is the first time that RFMG has been integrated into a propulsion system. Their results are really going to help us with guiding the future improvements of technology and integration for future Artemis missions, both to the moon and hopefully to Mars as well. And then finally, the LRA is the laser retroreflex array. And we've been doing some talking back and forth over the last 6 days to figure out whether or not it was possible to range to the retroreflector, and hearing from the PI of LRA, we do believe that the NASA LRO is going to be able to use their LOLA laser altimeter to range to LRA. So we will be working on that in the coming months, and very excited to have a location marker on the moon at 80 degrees south, so that this is going to be great for navigation in the future. So I know that Joel said that we've had 6 days, and I would actually say that we've had 13 amazing days. So we are at lucky number 13. In the first few days, we struggled to get communications, but the perseverance of the IM team, just not willing to give up, working with us, and as Steve noted, as soon as we landed and we started getting into what are we going to do and how do we do this, their team pulled us. They came down to our NASA back room and said, we need to work this. Come work with us, and pulled us all into mission control. So we were collaboratively working together to find solutions so that the spacecraft could live, the payloads could get their data. And instead of ending up with a few bytes of data, which was the baseline goal for us, we've gotten over 50 megabytes of data, which we went from basically a cocktail straw of data coming back to a boba tea size straw of data coming back. So we're all very excited now that we have gotten a lot of data back from the surface of the moon.
The Intuitive Machines spokesmen were keen to talk up their firsts on the IM-1 mission.
There were a number of firsts on this mission. We're particularly proud of our cryogenic propulsion system. This was the first time, again, that a cryogenic payload has been fueled on the pad. The first time a flight of a composite overwrapped linerless cryogenic tank has been attempted and succeeded. The first time a methyl ox engine has been fired in deep space, fired repeatedly in deep space. We enjoyed the fact that We set the record for length of an engine firing with our lunar orbit insertion, and then broke it the next day with our powered descent. So that was a good company to be in, we thought. It's a deeply throttling engine. We used thermodynamic venting systems for cryogenic cooling, inline processing of optical imagery, which enabled us to land safely. And then we collected a ton of multipath data from the lunar south pole region using our multiple antennas and radios.
Let me now digress with a report that is relevant to the Odysseus story. Japan's slim lunar lander was revived early last month after surviving the frigid conditions of the 14-day lunar night. Following receipt of a signal from SLIM, the lander's multiband camera was commanded to take images of rocks to determine their chemical composition. The 10-band spectroscopy observation was of more targets than originally expected. The images clearly showed the rocks illuminated from the east as compared with the western-lit rocks imaged in January. The multiband camera has an autofocus function which allows distances to be measured by focusing. Once the distance is known, the size of the rock can then be calculated. In this latest observing session, two high-resolution 10-band observations of rocks and regolith were made at 13 observation locations using 333 full-scan images at different wavelengths. This unexpected survival of the lunar night by SLIM has raised questions of whether Odysseus might also survive.
Well, I can address the surviving the night. You know, the real limiter, the number one limiter we face is the batteries. Batteries are a chemical asset. That chemistry does not respond well to deep cold. And so if something happens to the batteries for 14 days of less than 250 degrees, then we won't be able to come back up. And the batteries absolutely are not tested to that level of cold. Neither is our flight computer or our radios. If we asked our vendors to tell us what the probability was of surviving the deep cold of the moon, they would not put it in writing. And they shouldn't. So those are the things we're worried about. Our solar arrays should handle that fine. So we're confident that when the sun comes back up over Odysseus, that the solar arrays will energize and they'll send power. The real question is, are the batteries there to receive that power and pass it on? And then will the electronics within our computer and radio have withstood that deep cold and not basically cracked under the thermal stress? Wouldn't put odds on it, but those are the things we're facing when the sun comes back up on the solar array in a few weeks.
Yeah, and for my comment there is we're in a position where why not try, you know, with no odds on it. Let's see what happens and gain some data and insight that we otherwise wouldn't get if we weren't on the surface of the moon.
At the time of last week's press briefing, the solar panels were about to lose the sunlight. Reporters wanted to know how Odysseus would die.
Then I have some power questions. When is lunar sunset? When's the next sunrise? And how long do the batteries last when there's no more power being generated by the panel? Thank you.
And then for power, Odie runs about 100, 125 watts, kind of in the minimum power mode for the computer and the radios and the power distribution units and minimum heaters. So once and it's not exactly sunset that's the problem, it's the sun is now passing across the solar array that we have available. And so when the sun moves past that, it'll be just a matter of a few hours. And we were getting really close to that when we came in. Now, the good news is, as you look at the way Odie's laying on the surface, the sun is moving towards the engine this way. And so by tomorrow, it'll almost be completely over the engine. So even though the lander is still illuminated, this particular solar array is not. But when the sun comes back up in the east, we'll find out if everything else still comes on. That top deck is in a great position to pick the sun up at sunrise. And so we'll start listening at sunrise at our location and see if Odie wakes up from a nap.
88.3 Southern FM.